tonight on Arena. Neil Jordan on adapting novels for the screen, a new production of Chekhov's Three Sisters at the Gaiety, and a debut short story collection from Dave Tynan. If you'd like to text us, you can mail arena@rte.ie or find us on Instagram @rte_arena. Now, the Glens Centre in Manor Hamilton will be a hive of activity on the weekend of the 12th of September because it's opening its doors for the 12th Adaptation Film Festival, which will explore the relationship between literature and cinema. This year, they couldn't have chosen a more perfect featured artist than filmmaker Neil Jordan. He's adapted works as varied as Angela Carter's The Company of Wolves, Graham Greene's The End of the Affair, and Pat McCabe's The Butcher Boy and Breakfast on Pluto. I'm delighted that Neil Jordan joins me now. Neil, you've written most of your own original screenplays, but the adaptations are the focus of this particular festival, including the films that I just mentioned.
Sure, yeah.
So
yeah.
What is it about the original works that you've adapted in the past that drew you to them in the first place?
Well, I mean, if you're offered a book or a piece of work to adapt, you know, it's kind of a gift from the gods because half your work is done, you know. I mean, the nightmare for somebody writing an original thing is, where does it come from? Where does it go? You know, you have to kind of conjure something into being that wasn't there before. Whereas with, say, with Angela Carter's Company of Wolves, it was a beautiful thing. Angela wanted me to adapt originally a short story of hers, a very short. She'd adapted into a radio play. I read it, and I thought it was too short for a full movie. So I read her book, The Bloody Chamber. I said, look, why don't we come up with a structure where there are tales within tales within tales, and we'd be able to incorporate a lot of your other stories, mainly about, you know, wolves and wolfish and kind of wolfish lore and stuff like that, and about fairy tales, Red Riding Hood and stuff like that. So we did that, and so that was, you know, so I ended up collaborating with Angela on that. And that's the way the process goes, really, you know. If you're lucky enough to be given a good piece of work as a filmmaker and as a writer, it's kind of a gift.
It sounds like you had a good relationship with Angela Carter when it came to adapting. Was it always like that when it came to novels, original authors, when they were around and available? I presume that varied wildly from film to film.
It was fine, yeah. I mean, Graham Greene was dead, you know, so I did it myself. Anne Rice she had written a script for Interview the Vampire, which is probably the movie that most people have seen of mine. She had written a script, and I think she'd been very afraid of her own book in a way, you know, because she wanted to get it through the Hollywood system, so she neutered large sections of it, you know. And I read her script. I was asked to make it by Warner Brothers. And I reread her book. And I said, look, just give me a go at this myself. You know, I'll try and reintroduce a lot of the kind of terrifying, guilt-ridden Catholic subtext in her novel, and which I did. And they read it. And they put it into production very quickly, you know. So, I mean, Anne's problems with the movie were more to do with the casting. At the time, I cast Tom Cruise as a stat, and the whole world seemed to get upset with that. But then when they saw the movie, they all changed their minds, you know. So that's the way it goes generally. With Pat McCabe, he had written The Butcher Boy, which the challenge of that for me, or the attraction of that for me, was that it seemed to be untranslatable to screen, really, you know. And because everybody had this, their own image of that book, of that character, Francis Brady, and of his internal world and his descent into madness in kind of 1950s Catholic Ireland, you know. And I asked Pat to write a draft, which he did, but he departed from the book hugely. And I said, Pat, look, I kind of like the book that we bought, you know. And so I did another draft myself, and I reintroduced the voiceover of Francie Brady, and you know, and it was a delightful thing to do. It was great, you know. But I've generally done adaptions myself. I've only once or twice have I worked with the writers, Angela in one case, Pat McCabe in the other, you know.
I'm interested, are you the sort of filmmaker that finds yourself attracted automatically to work that is challenging? Because The Butcher Boy is one of those incredibly challenging, almost some would have said unfilmable books at the time.
Yeah, what Yeats called the fascination of what's difficult, isn't it? You know, but it's no. I mean, I knew the world. You know, I'd grown up in Clontarf. I was born in Sligo, actually, which is one of the reasons I go into Manor Hamilton. But I was born in Ross's Point. But I knew that world, that strange kind of illogical world that we all grew up in the 50s. And I knew it so intimately, and Pat's not, I didn't grow up in a small town, Pat came to Clonus, but it seemed to describe that world so perfectly, you know, and the mixture of kind of fantasy and reality and the way the kid confused, you know, comic strip images with kind of religious iconography and, you know, with the real world as he was living it, as it was collapsing around him. I kind of knew that world, and I really just wanted to bring it to the screen. That's why I made that movie, you know.
Okay, we're going to take a clip from that now. This is Eamon Owens and Stephen Ray.
It wasn't always like this, son. You'll never know how much I love that woman.
May the curse of Christ light upon ye, bitch. The day I took you out of that whole fish shop in Derry was a better one for me.
I came here to see you, son. If only you knew.
You have no son. You put me in a home like ours. What did I do?
I loved you like no father ever loved a son, Francie.
It was hard for him to say it. I could barely hear him. It would have been better if he drew out and hit me.
I only rewatched the Butcher Boy the other day, Neil, for the first time in a long time. And Eamon
Owens. Oh dear,
Owens,
but that sounds very sad. The movie is more fun than that, you know.
It was far from it. Eamon Owens' performance in it for a kid of his age at the time, it's still absolutely extraordinary to watch.
Yeah, he's astounding, isn't he? He is in that movie, and also in other movies. He was in John Borman's The General. Hmm. He played a small. He was in Angela's Ashes. I think Eamon actually gave up acting. He found it just a bit of a chore in the end, you know, but I mean he did some extraordinary stuff. But I mean, the thing is, when you get a movie like that, it kind of depends. It succeeds or fails on the central performance, you know. It's a bit like Mona Lisa with Bob Hoskins in it, you know. And there should be a name for that kind of movie where the entire experience comes through the central character, you know, a bit like Taxi Driver, Robert De Niro. You can't separate him from any one of the events that happens. And, you know, with The Butcher Boy, we had to get somebody that would not only make you believe what the kid was going through, but go through it with him, you know, make you inhabit the same world that he was working on. And I worked with Eamon we went to Clonus, and in Killeshandra, I think, we found three or four kids in a school. One was Eamon. The other was two friends, all in the same class, you know. And I don't think Eamon had ever been to a cinema, because there was no cinema in Killeshandra then, you know. And so I went through the entire script with him, but I followed him around with a video camera, you know. So by the time he came to do the movie, he had already kind of walked through it by about three or four times. There were like rehearsals that I did with him, you know. But it preserves that immediacy and that naturalism that, you know, young kids that age have, you know, which is very necessary. But I mean, it's all down to Eamon, that performance, you know.
What are you like as a reader of fiction? Are you reading something and already moments of it start to play themselves out cinematically in your head?
Oh, no, it's more difficult than that. You know, I mean, if you look at it nowadays, every movie that you see is made out of some kind of what they call an IP, you know, either a remake of an old movie or a kind of a version of a very popular book. Everything nowadays seems to depend on an existing kind of artifact, you know. Well, I mean, the movies, I they kind of chose me in a way, I think, you know. That's The Butcher Boy is a long time ago. You know, and the entire cinematic landscape has changed very, very radically, you know. But I think every movie is an adaptation in a way, you know. Even The Crying Game, which is an original script, you know, I adapted Frank O'Connor's Guests of the Nation and Brendan Behan's On Gael, The Hostage. You know, it's almost kind of a story or a situation that's written into the Irish political landscape, isn't it, where, you know, a bunch of activists kidnap somebody and the moment comes when an inevitable death is going to happen, and neither of them believe it's possible, you know, that kind of thing. And so, I mean, The Crying Game was an original script, but it was, you know, for the first third of it, definitely, I used Frank O'Connor's story quite blatantly, I think.
I'm going to take a clip from that now as well. This is Stephen Ray okay. and Forrest Whitaker.
Hey. What is it now? You're going to have to do it, aren't you?
Do what?
Kill me.
What makes you think that?
You're not going to let that guy out. And you're going to have to kill me.
They'll let him out.
You want to bet?
I'm not a gambling man.
And even if they do, you can't just let me loose.
Why can't we?
Not in your nature.
What do you know about my nature?
I'm talking about your people, not you.
What the fuck do you know about my people?
Only that you're all tough, undiluted motherfuckers, and it's not in your nature to let me go!
Shut the fuck up, would you?
That's Stephen Ray, Forrest Whitaker from The Crying Game. Neil, in terms of your own writing, in terms of novels and short stories, I mean, it's obviously a very different discipline to writing for the screen and eventually then getting a film made. But how similar are they in your own head as art forms?
It's very hard to work out. I mean, I'm kind of a weird amalgam of things, really, because I don't think many film directors are also writers. There are one or two, you know, but... to me, it's the same thing. I mean, the only difference is when you write a novel, you're on your own. You're kind of lonely. It's a lonely experience. When you make a film, you're surrounded by people who are, you know, you become like a circus. They all share the same ambitions. They know they kind of get a whiff of what you want to achieve. They can see the colors of it. They can see the dramatic kind of arcs of it. And, you know, so you're sharing an experience with others, which is kind of a gift again, you know. But I mean, writing is obviously it's a far more isolated activity. You don't write a novel with another person, you know. And but it's, you know, there's a freedom to writing novels too. I've just finished a new novel. I've just written a science fiction novel, actually, and it's kind of new territory for me, new territory probably for you know, kind of a lot of Irish writing in a way. But it's cool.
I have to ask you if you can tell us a little bit about that. That's an enormous tease.
What, the novel I've written?
Yes.
It's called The Library of Traumatic Memory, and it's set about 100 years in the future, and it's set another 200 years in the past. And it's about a medical corporation that has taken over the Beara Peninsula, where every inhabitant of the peninsula is undergoing various medical tests, various procedures and various solutions to baldness and to, you know, kind of skin kind of wrinkling and to heart disease and all that sort of stuff. So it's kind of crazy. It's rather wonderful. I really enjoy doing it, actually. But it'll be out in the new year.
I'm sold. You've worked with Stephen Ray many times. Even I was just thinking about that with the two clips we played there. Both have Stephen in them. Do you have a kind of shorthand with him when it comes to directing him?
Stephen would regard himself as an interpreter of writers. You know, I mean, he's worked with Brian Friel extensively. He's worked with Samuel Beckett. He's worked with Harold Pinter and Sam Shepard. You know. And I think I'm the only filmmaker he's had a consistent relationship with. But I mean, we started making movies together. We did that. We did that film Angel years and years ago. You know, I don't know how many years. In 1982, and it was the first movie I made. I think it was the first movie he made. You know, so we kind of went that experience together. We, you know, he even wore my overcoat, used my saxophone case in that film. You know, so it was a very intimate engagement, and it's continued to be that. I mean, I'd love to make one or two more movies with Stephen, you know, but we're both older now. And maybe cinema's a young man's game. I don't know. But there is one or two. There's one part in particular I'd love Stephen to play. I don't know if I'll be able to get financing for it, but we'll see.
How strange or difficult is it to adapt your own work? I know you've been working on a film of your own novel, The Well of St. Nobody, for a while. How's that going?
Well, it's going. I've written a beautiful script, but it's kind of what they call a drama, you know. And the word drama is anathema to the film kind of financing community at the moment. They love horror, they love action, they love superheroes, when they hear the word drama, they kind of leave the room almost immediately, you know. So it's I haven't gotten there yet, but I'd like to get there. I think I'll get there eventually.
Well, it's been brilliant talking to you this evening on Arena. Neil Jordan, thanks a million for joining us.
Thank you very much. Goodbye now. Cheerio.
The 12th Adaptation Film Festival runs from the 18th to the 21st of September, and its anchor venue is the Glen Arts Centre in Manor Hamilton, but films will be shown in the Drumahaire Library, the Sligo Omniplex, the Model and the Nyland Cinema. For more details, you can check out the website banditfilms.ie. Bold new adaptation of Anton Chekhov's classic play, Three Sisters, will make its world premiere at the Gaiety Theatre as part of the Dublin Theatre Festival next month. While retaining all the potency of the Russian classic, this ambitious production promises to speak for the times we live in. Director Mark Borul, did I get that right?
You did.
Close enough, we've had rehearsals. And designer Molly O'Cahan, much easier, are with me in studio this evening. Actor Megan Cusack, who plays the role of Masha, is joining us on the line from London as well. Welcome everybody to Arena.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Mark, it's been some time since the play has been performed professionally on stage in Ireland. Maybe for anybody who isn't familiar with Three Sisters, give us a brief maybe outline of the story and something about the context of the time it was written in.
Yeah, well, Three Sisters is about three young women who live in a small town, having moved from Moscow when they were children, and they've always dreamed about going back. And they live their lives stuck in this sense that it's going to begin. They sit in this small town and they wait for their lives to begin. And while they wait, everything happens. So it's a meditation on life, our ability to, our attempts to try and do the right thing as humans, to let our lives start the way we always imagined they would. And also, there's a stark message about waking up and doing things before it's too late. But it's also, Chekhov was so brilliant at analyzing human flaws and like the glorious messiness of just trying to be a good human. And I think he found loads of wit and humor in our failure to do that in everyday life. So it's both a beautiful meditative play, but it's also a very funny story of a family just trying to get by.
Do you think that some of those are the reasons as to why a play like this is still relevant 125 years on?
Yeah, I mean, Molly and I have always been really keen to create a production that doesn't reinvent the play. We're still telling the story as Chekhov wrote it, but we're trying to hit on the resonances between the play as it was written and our moment now. And so the story of three, really four young women whose lives have essentially been put on ice feels really resonant at this moment in time, middle of a housing crisis, post-pandemic. There's a feeling in the original play that society is on the edge of massive social change, but nobody really knows where the cards are going to fall, but everyone feels that something is about to shift. And obviously all of those things feel really potent right now. So I think there's some real connective tissue between the play then and the play today.
Molly, tell me about the production company that you guys have at Sugar Glass. You work quite closely as a duo from beginning to end. You've got quite a collaborative working style. Tell me how that works.
Yeah, I think Mark and I discovered that we wanted to have longer timelines to develop work where design and direction and kind of concept were co-created from an early stage in the process so that we could sort of collaborate on the vision for the visual as well as the kind of textual and everything else kind of from an early point. And we discovered that working together was something that really excited us and that it meant that we could then start dreaming up projects and productions and people we wanted to work with and people we wanted to bring into that from that point.
I would presume, maybe quite foolishly, that that's something that happens more often than not, but that's obviously not the case.
I think it happens quite a lot. I mean, there are definitely a lot of people who frequently work together, whether it's writer-directors or director-designers or director-sound designers. There are lots of people who, I think if you find your people, you want to hold on to them. That's a natural artistic impulse, particularly if you like working in a collaborative medium, like such as theatre is. But then I think it depends. If you're kind of jobbing as a sort of, I don't know, like a gun for hire designer, sometimes you get a call very late saying, will you come on board and do this? And you might not know the director or not might know their work, but not their working style or so on. And sometimes you're then playing catch up. So it depends. But yeah, I think ideally it's the way most people prefer to work. I would suspect.
That could be, as a designer, quite a schizophrenic way of having to work, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's brilliant. It depends. I think the more you have shorthand and the more you have a kind of a knowledge of what people want, the more secure you feel in knowing how to answer questions for them without needing to, you know, if you can read your director's mind, it's going to make life easier, because often we're managing really big groups of people and if every single question and decision needs to go through the director, you're going to create a bottleneck. So if you've got two people who can field those because you know that you've kind of created a shared language, then that's certainly going to sort of help. And I think it's exciting as well to kind of have the ability to know that you have someone who you can bounce back and forth with, but who you kind of know, oh yeah, this works. We don't, this path leads to generally to something fruitful and creative and dynamic rather than to conflict or stress or whatever. I think it's really reassuring to have people that you like working with.
It makes a director's life so easy to have someone you can collaborate with like that.
I'm going to bring in Megan Cusack, the actor. She's joining us from London this evening. She's not here in studio with us. Megan, you've just left Call the Midwife after, do I have that right, 4 years playing Nancy Corrigan?
Yeah, 4.5 years, and I made the decision sort of just over a year ago to leave and take the leap of faith, because the thing was, we filmed 7 months of the year and I missed theatre, and I thought I've got to take the leap of faith at some point.
And the theatre is a first love for you, and it's not something you were getting to do often enough, if I have that right?
No, I just think there's something really special about theatre. I grew up watching so much over in Ireland and travelling over to London to see it. And I think that whole thing of getting to spend, you know, 4 or 5 weeks in a rehearsal room with this group of people who are all working towards the same goal of telling a gorgeous story, and then getting to do it every night for however long you get the chance to. And each night probably being slightly different and you find more. I just think it's a really lovely experience, theatre.
There's a history in this for you as well, though, that people might not necessarily realise, because I think, is it 35 years ago since the Cusack sisters, of which you're part of the family, starred in The Three Sisters in the Gate in 1990?
Yeah, so there's no pressure. You know, there's no pressure.
I was going to say that later, yeah.
No, I mean, it feels... Three Sisters is a play that I've always loved. And, of course, there is history there, which is very special. I'm actually in the room. I'm looking at their poster currently. but what's so wonderful and special about this one is that we've got, you know, Ciara Elizabeth Smith, an Irish female playwright, reworking it. You know, no small feat taking on a Chekhov. But I do love when, you know, an Irish playwright takes a Chekhov. You know, you see it with Tom Murphy's Cherry Orchard. There's so many similarities between like Friel and, these relationships and families. And so often there's almost a sadness and a wistfulness and a longing in them that I think there's so many similarities between them that it makes so much sense to do it.
I should contextualise just very briefly that it is Sinead Cusack played Masha, Sorka Cusack
yes.
played
or
Olga, Niamh Cusack played Irina, and Cyril Cusack was in the play as well, and that you were all part of that particular acting dynasty because you're from Skibbereen in County Cork.
Yes, yeah.
It's. I'm going to ask maybe Mark the question of you. This play, does it still feel like a Russian play, or is it the sort of play whereby the roots can allow it to be transplanted anywhere else, since that's what's happening here?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, the plays have been adapted so many times in Ireland and elsewhere because, you know, there is, of course, a timelessness to what Chekhov is writing about. I mean, I think we all know that feeling of like, oh, our lives are going to start tomorrow, and then you realise it's already happened and it's too late. So I think he, you know, that timeless quality is in there. But the thing about adaptations is that they can, whereas Chekhov's play is so timeless, adaptations can feel like they go out of date so soon because they're written for the moment that you're in. So we're really excited to have Kira's brilliant new adaptation where she has given, we're not reinventing the play, but she's given the play a really contemporary voice. So the characters sound like people you would hear today. So our actors can tell this story from 100 years ago, but in a way that a new audience can immediately grab onto. And I think that really honors the spirit of Chekhov, because he wasn't interested in his plays sounding fusty or old-fashioned or people wearing period costumes. He wanted them to feel natural, of the now, speaking to the humans of his moment in time. So we're essentially just doing that 100 years later. And Kira's been so brilliant for this, because she's one of our great young Irish playwrights. And I think what's exciting about our production is that, you know, she's, you might not immediately go, oh, Kira should do a Chekhov adaptation, because her work is so contemporary. It's so very much of the new writing theatre. Her big debut play just went to the Royal Court, which is incredible. But both her and Chekhov are interested in this, the messiness of what it is to be human, these kind of everyday failures that we all have as humans, and the humour that's in that.
You are listening to Wednesday Night's Arena, and I'm talking to director Mark Borul, Molly O'Cahan, who's the designer, and actor Megan Cusack, who's with us from the London, I was going to say the London studio, but probably in you're sitting in your house in London. That's quite an old-fashioned thing to do. Megan, I was wondering, did you ever contemplate being something else other than an actor, or would you have been excommunicated from the family?
No, I think they would have been delighted. I was always told growing up, be either a plumber, an electrician, or a hairdresser, because you're always needed and you're always in work. And I didn't do that. but luckily, they're, you know, very proud of me now. But there was a time where it was like, really? But no, I don't think I ever did think of doing anything else. I think I was pretty set on it from a young age. And then I've been lucky enough to get to do it, really. Very grateful.
Tell me about Masha, the role you're playing in Three Sisters. She's the middle sister. What drew you to that part? And just, I suppose, to Chekhov in general.
I think, I don't know. You're kind of drawn to all of them. You know, I would have been happy to delve into any of the characters. Masha particularly, I think there's quite a few. Obviously, I never want to say too much because people will come and see it. But there's parts of Masha that I don't think I've necessarily tuned into myself as a person. I think, you know, all of the sisters are all longing for something. I think when they speak of Moscow, what Moscow means something different to all of them when I read it. You know, Masha is so attracted to intellect and, you know, interesting people. But I think there's a lot of kind of anger in her, which I sometimes struggle with anger. And I think that's just, I think you can be quite, it's quite vulnerable. So I'm interested in sort of delving into that side of myself through Masha. I think it's just, they're all interesting, but they all stand out. So I'm excited.
And working with part of this cast as well, because I'm going to ask you, Mark and Molly, about this. You've got a large ensemble cast here. I was originally told 14, which is now 13. It's 13. 13 must be an incredibly unlucky number to have.
This is why we can't talk about it, Rick.
Okay.
I'm touching wood.
You have a number of people in your cast.
Yes.
Tell me what it is about casts that have larger numbers in it. Is that a joy or is that just complex?
It's the best. I mean, it's what directors and designers dream of, because, I mean, it's one of the uniquely magic things, I think, about the theatre, that we can all gather to go and watch a large group of people tell us a story of a night. And, you know, in a digital age where we're trying to make sure we differentiate the theatre from other art forms, I think it's one of the things that is so uniquely special about it. You know, you're watching a story told by a group of people, but you're also watching a company of actors get along live in that moment. And So yeah, no, for us it's a dream. I mean, you know, as a director I get to work with so many different people on stage and all the configurations and how they exist in space, but also for a designer it allows you to do so much, right?
Yeah, like it gives us this really big palette to work with where we've made a design which is really quite stripped back so that we can use these like 13 amazing, live, exciting actors and bodies in space to create images and to tell stories that sort of the whole play is about relational kind of, you know, human relations between people, and we can tell that visually as well, and I think that's just so exciting. So I think, yeah,
because it is some cast list that you're dealing with, because aside from Megan, Lorcan Cranach is in it, Saoirse Monica Jackson from Derry Girls, Alex Murphy from Young Offenders, Mairead Tyres from Extraordinary, who people might have seen on Disney. How do you assemble a cast like that? That must be the tough part of the job.
With great luck, I think. we're counting our lucky stars. I mean, it's just an amazing group of people. And like you say, it represents, you know, some of the most respected senior theatre actors in the country, as well as people making their professional stage debuts. And, you know, that's how theatre companies used to work, right? Like there was a community of an intergenerational community who worked together, and, you know, the younger actors learned something from the more senior members of the company, and vice versa. And you know, we've been incredibly lucky to bring them together. It's also something that doesn't get to happen in the independent sector very often. You know, we're always being encouraged to make our work smaller and to fit into dwindling resources. And okay, if you're in one of the big houses, maybe they can still afford to do big productions. But Molly and I are always trying to be as crazy ambitious as possible, so it feels fun to be doing a production with this number of actors.
And is that the same story in terms of design? Do you have a slightly greater palette to work with, Molly, or does that not matter at all?
In terms of the scope of...
In terms of the scope of what you can do.
I think we... I'm hoping that we can be really detailed because we've been developing it for a long time, and we are really excited to kind of use... You know, we're not building a naturalistic box set. There's no living room. There's no chintzy curtains or anything. So, you know, we're sort of excited about how we can kind of hopefully create a sort of visual poetry on stage, and lean into the fact that it is theatre and it isn't film. You know, you can watch a beautiful period drama where everything's perfect and every teacup is correct. And we're not doing that. We're doing something else. There's 14 actors or 13 actors on stage tonight to tell you a story live in front of you. And that's sort of also quite simple. And then we do also have, you know, there's some a few ambitious
stage tricks up our sleeves.
We'll see if we can deliver. So yeah, it's ambitious for sure. And then with costume as well, I think I'm really excited by the costume design. We've kind of really inspired by Kira's brilliant text and her kind of approach to the how contemporary it is and feels. I'm taking the same approach with my costume design, and so we will be really focusing on, like, how do you relate to these people today? How do you feel that you recognize them, know them? I mean, the cast is extraordinary, and it's extraordinarily youthful. There's a huge number of, you know, for a big canonical play, there's a lot of very young people, a lot of young characters in this text. And there's a lot of really interesting, cool women who are flawed and weird and, you know, kind of driven demented by themselves and each other and trying to figure it all out. And I love that, and I want to try and find ways to design so that these are people that you can relate to, that you can recognise and know, and that I think that amplifies the sort of the point of it somehow, to gather together and relate to these people rather than, I don't know, corsets and skirts and things that make you go, these are things that some other people far away once felt and they don't pertain to me.
It's not a production for people who, only for people who already know the play, you know. We're hoping that a new audience can come who may have heard of the play or may have never heard of the play, but can come in and instantly find recognition in it.
You've alluded to it sort of very briefly, but you're part of the Dublin Theatre Festival.
Yeah.
That's obviously something that's quite important.
Yeah, I mean, the festival is such an amazing time in Dublin, and they're so good at bringing the best international work to the city, but also at championing Irish artists who are trying to do something different or trying to do something of a scale that they might not be able to do outside of festival time. So we're incredibly grateful that that they took a chance on this ambitious, you know, we said to them, 13 actors, Chekhov, the Gaiety, and they sort of said, yeah, let's go, which doesn't happen every day. So it's they've been incredibly supportive, and obviously they have a wonderful audience who are excited to see new adaptations of classics. So we're excited to meet them there.
Megan, as an actor, the joys of live theatre as opposed to doing something like a long-running TV series like Call the Midwife, what's that like?
I think it's just like there's a buzz. There's a buzz that you can't get when you're doing telly. I mean, the thrill of telly is sometimes it's so quick paced that you don't even know what you're doing. You're like, okay, we've got 5 minutes. We've got to get this scene done. Whereas theatre, it's like it's the anticipation. You're all there together as a company, stood side of stage, waiting to go on and see what sort of unfurls. Because, you know, obviously you don't know what's going to happen and you don't know how an audience will react. People will react differently to something in it than the night before. And then you go with that and you let that inform, you know, the rest of the story that evening. I just think you're kind of uncomparable, really.
Mark, I may finish just by asking you what you think it is about Chekhov that means that theatre makers keep turning to him again and again and again. Because it may have been a while in Dublin since there's been a full production of this, but I've seen productions of The Seagull and Cherry Orchard over the years and the Andrew Scott one-man Vanya recently. Why Chekhov? What is it about him?
I mean, I think that he was such a, you know, Chekhov was a doctor and as well as a playwright. I think he described himself as a doctor before he described himself as a playwright. And I think he had this unbelievable capacity for empathy and for observation of human behavior. And so in a word, I think the answer is messiness. He understood that humans are more complicated than they seem and that what they say and what they mean and what they do are often very far from one another. And so the gorgeous challenge for a company of actors like the one we've assembled is that you have all of the words that they say, but you also have this whole life that's happening underneath the play that is rich for exploration, that is not on the page, and that is all to do with this kind of brilliant subtext that he found.
Mark Atkinson Barul, designer Molly O'Cahoyne, actor Megan Cusick joining us from London as well. Thanks so many for joining us tonight on Arena. It'll make its world premiere at the Gaiety Theatre as part of the Dublin Theatre Festival next month. The play has been adapted by Kira Elizabeth Smith. It'll be performed at the Gaiety from the 8th to the 12th of October and also at the Drieacht in Blanchardstown on the 4th of October. An award-winning director of short and feature films, Dubliner Dave Tynan has just published his debut collection of short stories, We Used to Dance Here, which engages with the housing crisis, toxic masculinity, messy breakups and the aftermath of COVID. And Dave Tynan joins me now in studio. Dave, why were you, we were having this conversation before we went on air. Why write a short story collection?
It wasn't my background. My background's more film. So I'd always been writing, but not writing fiction. Then I started doing that, and then in order to, I suppose I thought I can do 5,000 words, I can do one short story, I will try that, and the short story form rewards that, like, you know, line by line, the craft of it, like making a little Swiss clock or something. So then you get one published, and then you start thinking, then you start getting notions and thinking, we'll build this up. And within all of them, you know, the sum is greater than the parts. I suppose that's the, and they can kind of talk to each other and it's polyphonic like that. And that was interesting to me. I didn't, so the short answer is, I would have been too scared to write a novel. Yeah.
I think you're very much right about the stories talking to each other in this collection. So let me talk to you about a few of them. So Tourists is the one that starts the collection. It kind of sets the tone at the very beginning and kind of establishes some of the themes that happen during the story. So tell us a little bit about Connor in this story and how maybe his perception of the world changes when he meets Shannon, the American.
Yeah, so it's, I kind of wanted to do something about, I grew up in town, but I didn't go to Trinity. I wanted to do something about, like, Trinity has been in Irish literature, feels like, forever. And I was interested in kind of starting with Trinity and then leaving it. And he doesn't go to Trinity. He's out of college, first person to go to college from his family, doesn't have a job, or doesn't have a job he likes anyway. He's like working in a pub. And then meets an American who is in Trinity. And I thought there was something in that. And I suppose there's a lot of stories in it. People are slightly outside of things. So, yeah, that I thought that was the kind of the key to it.
And it gives him an opportunity to maybe look at Dublin in a way that he wouldn't have otherwise, through the eyes of somebody who has a very romanticised view of Dublin.
Yeah, because I think, there's tourists' versions of Dublin, and I'm interested in, like, kind of puncturing those, I suppose, that if you could be visiting Dublin and, you know, you don't see past kind of Temple Bar or Georgian Dublin or, you know, the Viking splash boats in that story. And there's hundreds of other Dublins, I suppose. And then the rest of the book probably starts to look at those. But to begin with, you know, to suggest that all tourists can't see the rest of it, and then to try and go into those after that.
Yeah. I was talking to Neil Jordan earlier on the programme, who, like yourself, makes films, but also writes as well. Do you enjoy the solitary process of writing, or is your heart elsewhere in terms of, like, do you prefer the collaborative nature of filmmaking?
Day-to-day films, I think it's more fun doing it with other people. But that's, you know, I don't see it as binary now. Now that I've got a book out and I'm here and all the lovely Arena listeners are listening. That feels great and very proud of it. Day to day, I prefer to be on set than in the library. Just personally, that suits me more. But there's things I love and hate about both of them.
The people in the stories in this book, the generation of young Irish people who are in here, some of them are in a state of flux. For some of them, emigration is a choice. For some of them, it's a necessity. In How Do You Know Them, the story, it could start out as a possible meet-cute. It maybe feels a little bit like that in the beginning, but then that's not what that story is about at all.
No. And I like trying to play with those kind of... Like, also, Crispy Bits is another one that, you know, looks... It starts with a breakup. And then, so I like playing with that kind of stuff formally, first off, but also... Yeah, that's about, like, kind of, I nicked this from a mate, so thank you, Aaron. But the wedding industrial complex, that age when you feel like you're going to, like, nearly a wedding every weekend or whatever. And if that's, if life otherwise isn't working 100% for you, then the kind of, the huge overarching, like, bludgeoning of going to a wedding and the expense of it and the show, all of that kind of seems to throw up. Or can throw up your life in, like, pretty stark relief, and you might not like what's around there. So, yeah, it's about two people not getting together at a wedding.
And two people, both of whom live in the UK. So there's a whole other element of that to them. And they live quite closely to each other in London.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I just thought that was nice. That was that's the little emotional disemboweling at the end that, like, they could have met there. And then they also could have met for the next couple of years that they, you know, there's spoilers in this now, but... Maybe that's not the only reason you'd read short stories. Yeah.
I like the phrase emotional disemboweling at the end, because my favourite story is Dogman in the collection.
Okay.
And it is one that is, for almost all of the story, about one thing. It's about a father. It's about his relationship to a son. And then by the time we reach the very end of it, the story has become something very different. So obviously that is something that you feel as a writer is something that works for you.
That the father and son relationship. Sorry,
the nature of telling a story, but then allowing us to find ourselves in a very, very dark, different place by the time we've made it to the end.
Yeah, that you get to, well, stories or journeys, and that one particularly, like, that was probably the trickiest one out of all of them to write. I think it was the last one I finished, because it has so many characters within it. So you're cycling through things. Like, that's probably, like, that's not the smartest thing to do when you're writing a short story, to try and then put a bunch of different characters through it. And obviously people haven't read it yet. So it's set in a dog track and all the different people at that dog track. And how there's a kind of hierarchy and there's a whole world within it. But that the father and son, yeah, that relationship changes, but not necessarily in a... I think it's a good complex story. I'm proud of it in that sense.
I know you might have written a short story collection because you thought that maybe there was less pressure than attempting to write a novel. But for a lot of people, the short story, because of what you said, because that craft that goes into all of the truly fantastic ones, some would say there's more pressure in that. Did you not feel that at the time when you were writing them?
No. I would have thought, I literally didn't think of it. I can now look and think I can have a cut at a novel, but I didn't at the time. I just thought, I kind of did it on length. Like, if I can make 10 pages, great. Then that's something. A short story to me was like the same as a screenplay or something. It's not too many words.
What about the title of the collection, We Used to Dance Here? It kind of says a lot. Where does it come from?
It came from my head, like the rest of the book. I thought that there's no we's. It's all written in third person. So we was a way of, I suppose, bringing all the characters together. Here, obviously, is Dublin, and it's Dublin. Like, it's a kind of recent period piece. It's like 2016, 2020. And then dance, obviously dance, but like I saw that as a broader thing. And I think it's about a kind of passage of time. And it's just one of those things, like any good line or that just has a kind of textural quality that when I thought of it, I thought that's the title, done. Like, and it hasn't changed since. So that's nice.
I wanted to ask you just before we finished about the characters in a lot of these stories. Some of them emigrate, some of them return, some of them have very fractured relationships with Dublin as a city, which is the backdrop for almost every story in this. What's your relationship like with Dublin City?
I love it, but I was probably writing a lot of this when I didn't feel like it was giving me much back. Like, you're in a kind of... you're the weak, or you're in a relationship that's not working, but you do want it to work. Maybe that's where I was at. Yeah,
it's a great collection of short stories. Thanks a million, Dave Tynan, for coming in to join us tonight on Arena. We Used to Dance Here is published by Granta Books, and that is it for Arena for tonight. Show is produced by Shannon Gorman. Paula Shields was the researcher. Broadcast coordinator was Ollie Hamilton, and sound supervision by Paul Murnock. That's it from me, Rick O'Shea, as well. I'm off on Holliers for a couple of weeks. Aideen Gormley will be in the chair taking care of you tomorrow night from 6:30. John Creedon is next.